To the rich man's bright lodges I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you.
I do not posit that there has been a secret conspiracy to take over the government. I think there are processes. Nobody really controls it. People at certain moments made some key decisions. I think they were always ad hoc things, not like this is step one in establishing the deep state. It was just, no, the president has to go. These are processes. The instruments are there, the machinery is there, the personnel keep changing. But once these processes are in motion, then they acquire their own logic. For example, if the governing media of this country commit themselves to the position that the president was killed by a lone nut, then they're committed to lying for eternity, really. For them to tell the truth about the Kennedy assassination would mean to have to say we participated in a lie for the public good, but nonetheless a lie.
You're listening to episode 719 of Unwelcome Guests, The Processes and Logic of the Deep State. I'm Robin Upton. And I assembled that short set of quotes from today's speaker, Professor Peter Dale Scott, because I don't want you to get lost in details. If you can take them on board, then great. But we've had a lot of new listeners to the show, so I thought let's give an overview over what this entity, the US Deep State, actually is. Now, who better to do that than Professor Peter Dale Scott, who coined the phrase the deep state and deep politics. As he highlights, we don't need to think of a parallel government as being a mirror of the publicly available government with responsibilities and duties. No, it's much more like, say, mafia bosses in a loose alliance, sometimes rivalry, with one credo to which they all adhere, that their doings must remain secret. I think that's a fatal flaw in this age of burgeoning communications technology. So quite apart from the other self-destructive logics, that would be enough to bring this system down. Many thanks to Dark Journalist, who recorded the following excellent interview. The audio quality itself is not up to the standard of the interviewing, so that's disappointing. If that's a real problem for you, then please let me know via feedback. I just got used to it and managed to make good sense of what Peter Dale Scott was saying. This was carried out in January 2015.
Now, I thought we'd start our discussion today by having you define what the deep state is, what does it encompass, and how would an average person understand its role in our daily lives?
Okay, well, we can begin by saying that there is a gap in attention between the institutions that are defined by the Constitution or responsible to the Constitution on one level, and then the second level, institutions like the CIA and the NSA, which operate in secret. There's something about secret power that it's not controllable, and it's very important that the CIA's budget has never been exclusively a budget voted by Congress. So it's a level of the deep state higher than the public state. And then I want to go to a third level, but we skip to the fourth level, which are ultimately, Roosevelt himself said to a friend back in 1933, you and I know that a financial element has been controlling this country since the age of Jackson. That's the ultimate level, I think, is extreme wealth and the institutions that deal with extreme wealth. But in between, there's a third public level, CIA level, and then companies like Booz Allen Hamilton that interface with the CIA, recruit from the CIA, and are recruited by the CIA. And then they also work with corporations all over the world and with banks all over the world. And the same thing happens. There's an interaction of a revolving door, both between these corporations and the CIA, and also between these corporations and the highest level of banks and major oil companies and so on.
Okay.
And so the ensemble is a level, you have levels of government, some of which are written about in the media and some of which are not written about in the media. You very rarely see Booz Allen Hamilton in the headlines, but if you write what I would call a deep history of, say, American relations with Egypt, the CIA is going to be in that history, and the Booz Allen Hamilton are going to be in that history.
Right. So ordinarily, we're looking at the public side of our society, elective government, law and order, justice, daily news reporting, and that kind of thing. But underneath, there are these deep state forces that are operating in contracting for intelligence agencies, in corporate, financial, and political circles, and they are having an impact with very little transparency.
Right. So there's a lot of things in the deep state that I talk about in this woolly way, because we think of history as taught in universities is archival history, working with documents. And that gives us, that's a good method, and we get good history, but we get limited history because a lot of what's going on in the deep state is undocumented.
Right.
And when people like me try to write deep history, we have to resort to all kinds of techniques to fill the vacuum, because we don't have, every now and then we're lucky and we get a document here.
Yes, well, there have been some breakthroughs, I would say, with Freedom of Information Act requests, even if they are few and far between. Now, can you think of a document that when it came out, it just made you stop and say, this is major?
A key one. We have the CIA document after the Kennedy assassination instructing the media on how to handle it. And they use the phrase conspiracy theory. As far as I know, that's the first time that we have a document that talks about conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
It's CIA telling the newspapers how to attack people like me.
Right. And the basic instructions from the CIA to their media assets was call them conspiracy theorists, and that will have the effect of marginalizing them and take some of the heat off.
Right, exactly. Well, we don't get many of those documents. We get a few. But we have to look around the known world that we see and we read about in the newspapers. And I think actually most Americans have some awareness of this. You know, if they live in a city like Chicago.
Sure.
Maybe not now, but 50 years ago, the mob was in City Hall. And anybody who had anything to do with City Hall knew that because they had to pay certain people off and so on.
Right.
It's not in the official history of Chicago.
Well, this is interesting because you've done some real investigation on how organized crime is a component of the deep state and has these connections that we don't hear very much about.
That's where I really began with this kind of analysis, because I wrote a book called Deep Politics and the Death of JFK.
That's an excellent book.
The biggest gap in the Warren Report was when they were saying that Ruby was a loner, when Ruby was obviously somebody very clued in with the mob, and that's half of it, also very clued in with Dallas high society, and above all, clued in with the Dallas police. And we actually have testimony from Dallas police officers saying they used Jack Ruby as an informant on the drug traffic. And we have somebody else who told the FBI that a big drug deal only went through in Dallas after Jack Ruby gave the okay on it.
Uh-huh.
Now, the Warren Commission received these documents, and then they said he was a loner. Well, that taught me that you have to see more to politics than what's on the record.
Yeah.
And organized crime was where I went in. That led me to the drug traffic. It led me to the CIA.
And, yes, and you found that interface between the CIA and organized crime.
Yeah.
In your book, Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, you outline all of these intelligence connections that Oswald had and how through these connections he was set up to appear in a certain way as a kind of leftist loner, and that this method was actually used in 9/11 also, but there it was applied to 19 people instead of just one.
Yes, I think that I have more than one book where I draw attention to the analogies between Kennedy assassination and 9/11. And this is one of them, that the what I call the designated culprits.
Yeah, that's a great term.
People who were already known to the agencies, in the CIA in particular, and in both cases, the CIA was covering up both on Oswald and on the alleged hijackers to make sure that they would not be rounded up before the deep events that they are attached to, because then they couldn't have been the designated culprits.
I see. So on a certain level, they're being protected right up to the point where they can be used in a scapegoat role.
Right. And that's a matter of history now with Oswald, but it should be a matter of grave concern, and actually is right now. People campaigning to get those 28 pages from the Joint Congressional Investigation of 9/11 released. We pretty well know a good deal of the story by now anyway, but it would be an official documentation of the Saudi money going to these alleged hijackers, the CIA's protection of these hijackers, the lying, saying that they had given money to the information to the FBI when in fact they had refused to give, as they should have given the information to the FBI. All of that would come out. That would be one way, I think, of ending the state of emergency we're in, to see the really corrupt way in which it was instituted in 9/11 in the first place.
Right. So you could almost say that Oswald and the hijackers share this kind of archetype of how to portray someone as an off-balance fanatic, but with no outside connections to any state sponsors or intelligence organizations.
Yeah.
One of the things that you've said in relation to the state of emergency that we're still in is that we've actually been under it for 13 years already, but a lot of people don't seem to know that. Or that NORTHCOM has, since 2008, an army division based here in America that's set up to deal with public unrest. So these are two things you don't hear a whole lot about, but are critical in your view.
Yes. I think one of the difficult periods of American history was the Reconstruction era, when the South was, in effect, subjugated and occupied by an army. And the Reconstruction ended with a disputed election in which a president was elected by a deal to end the occupation, which they did. And so we had a century of Jim Crow, thankfully somewhat over now, not completely. But we also had the Comitatus Acts, which became part of the effective American style of government, that you do not use the military in a permanent way for law enforcement and homeland security.
Yes.
And we all upended that. The division has been there since 2008, but NORTHCOM has been there since 2002. It was part of and it had been planned for by COG. Three things had been planned for: warrantless surveillance.
Uh-huh.
We all know about that now from Edward Snowden. Warrantless detention, and most people are not aware of that. Just yesterday, I found a very knowledgeable man, not aware that something like 1,000 Muslims, maybe more, were rounded up after 9/11 without a warrant, without charges, held, interrogated. In the case of one man that I talked to, badly beaten until there was blood in his urine.
Wow.
And this is, reminds me of the Jews in Germany. Also being persecuted and punished, and people afterwards said, "Oh, I didn't know." Americans would say, honestly, they didn't know about these Muslims, but they should.
Yeah.
They should, because it is a blot that we have habeas corpuses mentioned in the Constitution, but it was just torn into shreds by COG planning. And so you have warrantless surveillance, warrantless detention and the permanent militarization of Homeland Security. Originally, it was plans for martial law, that we don't quite have that, but we do have now a military component, not only to law enforcement and dealing with disturbances, but also surveillance. The military are involved in the surveillance of people like you and me.
Exactly.
And they shouldn't be.
Yeah. Now, on COG, this is something you've done some amazing research on and really brought to light. But there's a common misconception out there that COG was something that was around during the Cold War and then sort of went away in the 90s. But that's not the case, is it?
No.
And just to clarify, COG is continuity of government, in which the government would implement emergency planning in the event of an incredible emergency.
An atomic attack, originally.
Right, an atomic attack, and exactly.
The decapitation of the government. See, the Constitution says, oh, if you lose the president, then the vice president becomes the president. But supposing a bomb lands on Washington and you lose the president and the vice president and the Speaker of the House, this was very legitimate planning to deal with an atomic attack, because we were threatening atomic attacks from time to time, and so was Russia.
Uh-huh.
But what happened in the right after the Reagan Revolution in 1982, they started the. This was Casey and I think Vice President Bush, and certainly Oliver North, who was the executive officer. They started conceiving of COG, continuity of government planning, to deal with domestic crises. North was very keen on rounding up Hispanics who were supporting the Sandinistas, but Hispanics in this country, citizens in this country. And they passed an executive order towards the end of Reagan's administration, but which said that COG planning was to deal with any emergency, not just an atomic emergency. And then in 1994, there was an unfortunate story in the New York Times by, I believe, Tim Weiner, that said that there was, it actually said that all of this COG planning had ceased. And it was true that they decided to, not work after the fall of the Berlin Wall, they ceased planning for an atomic attack. But they did not at all cease planning for the implementation of COG. And in fact, they intensified it. And what was really disturbing here was that in 1994, we had a Democratic president, Clinton.
Right.
And according to a very good book by Andrew Coburn, Clinton didn't really know what was going on, but the planning continued. And this is, to me, very significant, that two of the key planners have been in there ever since 1982 and were in there up until Bush was elected, or if that's the word, in 2000, were Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. They spent 20 years planning for the implementation of COG, and then on 9/11, while the president was out of the Capitol, those same two men implemented it. And because they had the power to do it, because the executive order said it was for any emergency, and they said 9/11 is an emergency. And they proclaimed, when the president got back, he proclaimed officially an emergency, and that's the emergency we're still under. And that's why there's a permanent army brigade stationed inside the United States to deal with any dissident rally that might get out of control. We're in a kind of, I don't want to say police state,
yeah.
Because we used to have police running us, but no, now we have the military in charge of Homeland Security, and that's in contravention of the comitatus laws that we used to have. So it's a very significant change. And so my book hopes that we will do something about this. And the very first step, as far as I'm concerned, is to have a debate in Congress to end this state of emergency.
Very interesting. Now, a couple of points I want to pick up on there when you're talking about continuity of government planning going on behind the scenes. Now, Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney were, at times, when they were making these plans, not even in government. They were private citizens in high-ranking corporate positions. Is that right?
Exactly. They were chairman of organizations the whole time. That was the status of Rumsfeld. In the 1980s, most of the 1980s, Cheney was a congressman from Wyoming.
Right.
Why a single congressman should be picked out to plan for this is planning for suspension of the Constitution. This is very serious planning, never authorized by Congress. It was it was all done by executive order. And then in the 90s, under Clinton, Cheney was, of course, briefly Secretary of Defense with the first President Bush.
Yeah.
But then he was the CEO of Halliburton. Halliburton had a huge stake in what was going on because they were heavily involved in the development of U.S. oil investments in Kazakhstan and Central Asia. And one of the chief consequences of 9/11 has been putting U.S. troops into Afghanistan and then Iraq, which was of major importance for the oil companies in Kazakhstan. They wanted to have U.S. troops around to make sure that the president of Kazakhstan would listen to the United States and not just to Russia, which also had troops in the area.
Uh-huh.
So Halliburton was not disinterested in this, but you had two CEOs of private U.S. corporations planning for the U.S. suspension of the U.S. Constitution, and it was done, according to Andrew Coburn, in the 90s, it was different from the 80s. 1980s, it had Democrats and Republicans, but the group in the Pentagon who were planning specifically on military responses in the 1990s were, according to Coburn, nearly all Republicans who despised Clinton. So it was like a government in waiting.
Yeah.
For the what we got in the year 2000, thanks to the Supreme Court.
Right. And one of the main players, if we want to predate the 90s and take a look at the 80s, was Oliver North, who, of course, was a key figure in the Iran-Contra scandal.
Right.
Now, what can you tell us about North and some of his positioning in relation to COG? You mentioned one intriguing thing in the book that he was very involved in called Rex 84. Can you tell us about that?
Right. I should have said that from the very beginning, FEMA was created under Carter. I think that their role was political from the beginning. I don't want to get into the Carter era, but in the Reagan era, they were the support group for COG planning. The executive officer for the COG planning was North, who, of course, was also the operations man on the Iran. Now, one of the biggest budget items of COG planning was to set up an alternative communications network, which was independent of the basic government communications network. This is sometimes called the Doomsday Network. That's the Pentagon's own term for it.
Yeah.
Just as the seat of government, if they're had been an atomic plan, would have been what they call the doomsday plane. I have the cover of my book, which I hope you can see.
Oh, yeah.
That doomsday plane over the White House, because that actually happened on 9/11, and nobody has ever been able to explain why a plane was there over the White House, which, of course, is prohibited airspace. No airplane, ever. Was supposed to be there. Anyway, Rex 84 was an exercise. The EX in there is an exercise, but it was an exercise in rounding up Americans.
Uh-huh.
So that is a clear sign that we've changed the emphasis on continuity of government planning to kind of civilian control. And that's, of course, the feature of Oliver North's activities.
Uh-huh.
But there's a close intimacy between the COG planning and the Iran-Contra affair.
Okay.
Because certainly the early stages of sending arms to Iran was not authorized. And Oliver North had a solution to that. He used the emergency network that had been set up for COG for the practical job of getting arms sent through Portugal without the U.S. ambassador to Lisbon being aware of this.
Uh-huh.
So that it was the underpinning for what Oliver North was doing. And this is maybe getting a bit ahead of your questioning, but one of the things I say in my book is that the COG network, the Doomsday Network, figures in all of these major deep events. 9/11 itself, it was implemented on that day. That's why the president and the vice president all through that day didn't stay in town together. First of all, Cheney, who was in Washington, told Bush to stay away, and then when Bush came back, Bush went, by the way, to Offutt Air Force Base, which
right.
is the base for the Doomsday planes. And then when he came back, Cheney went away, and he went away for 90 days and lived inside a hollowed-out mountain, which was part of the planning for COG. And he took a huge staff with him, almost 100 people. And what they did is off the books,
I bet.
I think we can speculate with some certainty that that's where they refined the Patriot Act,
yep.
which emerged out of nowhere. And certainly something called Project Endgame, which was a massive program for building detention centers, which was a kind of implementation of what had been exercised in Rex 84 back 17 years before.
And who do you think they're planning to detain in these centers, according to the documents?
Well, I can say with more confidence about the 1984 period, they were very focused on Hispanics because they didn't want domestic protests to what Reagan was doing with the Sandinistas.
Okay.
And there was a group called CISPES. And it came under attack from a number of directions. The FBI, the CIA set up something they shouldn't have set up. But specifically, the detention centers would have been rounding up members of CISPES. And if they were not nationals, then deporting them back to Central America. And that did actually happen. And it was really sending people off to a death sentence. If you took somebody from CISPES in America, sent them back to El Salvador, you had a ruthless military dictatorship in El Salvador, and there was all kinds of killings going on. Then nuns were killed, Jesuits were killed, a bishop was murdered.
Right.
It was a very bloody time in Central America. And I regret to say that the things that Vice President Bush and William Casey, who was the head of the CIA at the time, and Oliver North in particular, the things they were doing were war crimes. And I don't know if we'll ever get some kind of accounting for that, but they were definitely war crimes.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Now, when you speak about deep events and how they were linked with this Doomsday Network, let's take a snapshot of all the major deep events that have happened, starting with the JFK assassination, bringing us up to the present. What would you say are the five most crucial deep events that have happened in American history?
Yes, well, when we come to the Kennedy assassination, what's that got to do with the Doomsday Network? The answer is, well, there are many. It's quite a complex answer, but I'll just single out one salient detail to stand for the rest.
Okay.
And that is that the Secret Service agent who came down from Washington to plan the parade route, which ended up going by the school book depository where Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly shot at the president.
Yeah.
That Secret Service agent, all his communications were on the White House Communications Agency network, which was a branch of the Doomsday Network.
Aha. Uh-huh. So
And if I could jump fast forward to the 9/11 before I fill in what's in between.
Sure.
That network, I'm sure, was used again on 9/11. And the 9/11 Commission, looking for key decisions that were made, like the implementation of COG, they reported that they could find no record of the phone calls.
Oh.
And in another book I wrote, The Road to 9/11, which I summarize in this book, I made an argument that Cheney, you know, spent right in the middle of all this crisis. He was not in the what we call the PEOC, or the Emergency Operations Center, underneath the White House. He was somewhere else at a telephone. That was, I'm quite convinced, a Doomsday Bay network telephone. And the 9/11 Commission report records that, yes, COG was implemented on that day. And then they have a footnote and say that, in which they say they did not look into COG. Well, that's like saying they didn't look into the very heart of 9/11.
Exactly.
Because the really key decisions, I think, were made on the COG network. I don't think they were ever given access to that network. So they tried to cover that up by saying it's okay, we just didn't look into it. Well, they didn't look into it because they couldn't look into it because they didn't have the clearances. All right, now let's go back. After the Kennedy assassination and this man, Winston Lawson, who was this key Secret Service agent, by the way, not the only person. I have a whole article that's complicated.
Yeah.
We come to Watergate, and the key burglar, James McCord, was also part of a secret Air Force unit that was planning for rounding up. I could read you the description if you like. We know what his job was there. And again, he was part of the Doomsday Network.
That's interesting.
And John Dean, who is the man who caused so much trouble for Nixon inside the White House, says in his book, Worse Than Watergate, he mentions that he was in charge of COG planning when he was in the Pentagon before he went to the White House.
So wow.
He actually took part in the COG planning. So you have two key figures, John Dean and James McCord, both part of this Doomsday Network. The Doomsday Network, when we come to the prevention of the re-election of Carter, I really don't have very much to say there, but I will speculate. This is
okay.
I think I maybe.
And here you're speaking about the October surprise.
Yeah, arms went to Israel then, and many books say that the networks that were used to send arms to Israel in 1980 were the same networks that were used to send arms to Israel in 1985-86. That brings us, in other words, to Iran-Contra.
Okay.
Absolutely no doubt that Oliver North was part of the Doomsday planning in 1985-86. We have these documents like Rex 84. And there's absolutely no doubt that he used what it was called, I think, Flashboard at the time. That was his name for it. But he was using a network outside of the regular communications network to negotiate these arms deals. So I suspect, although I have no proof, that if the setup in 1985 was the setup in 1980, then the secret network would have been used then too, because there were so many deep state personnel involved in this negotiating of the arms deal. And, you know, William Casey was not yet the director of Central Intelligence.
Right.
But had intelligence connections, and he was definitely a key figure in 1980 in flying to Paris and negotiating with Iranians about getting arms to Iran in exchange for a commitment not to release the hostages that had been seized in the U.S. embassy. And this proved to be true. They were not to be released until Reagan was inaugurated.
Yep.
The day that Reagan was inaugurated is the day that Iran released the hostages. That's a kind of corroboration of that this deal was made.
Fascinating. And we have Vice President Bush deeply involved in these operations.
He was North's boss. They had a structure. They're doing a lot of different initials for different committees and things. But over and over, it's Vice President Bush's responsibility, and all of North is the executive officer.
It is interesting how Bush Sr. shows up over and over again in these deep events. And I guess we need to remember that he was the CIA director in 1976. And that's one thing that got my attention when you wrote that 1976 was a crucial year in deep state activity. And you tied it in with all these Saudi arms shipments. And in a previous book, I read you were going to skip the Ford era completely. But eventually you realize all of these important things happened there. And it was a critical period of time to cover.
Right. That really all happened in my thinking when I was writing The Road to 9/11. And I ended up devoting a whole chapter to what I call the critical period of change. A number of things happened there. First of all, Congress had started to look into what the CIA was doing, and elements of the CIA, and Vice President Bush, when he became the director, was a key figure in this, they essentially went offshore. You know, if Congress is going to look at us, well, then we'll have other people do things for us. That's the year in which something called the Safari Club was created.
Right. And can you give just a quick description of what the Safari Club was and who was in it?
The Safari Club is a coming together of the heads of intelligence. The America doesn't figure in the masthead of the Safari Club, but they're behind it pulling the strings. One key figure is Alexandre de Maranche, who was the head of STEC, which is the French intelligence network, and he becomes a key figure advising Reagan even before Reagan is inaugurated.
Huh.
He's part of the kitchen cabinet advising Reagan. And then after that is the head of SAVAK in Iran, and this is very significant because the U.S. ambassador to Iran at this time is Richard Helms, who formerly had been the head of the CIA.
Oh, yeah.
And then you get the head of Saudi intelligence and the head of Egyptian intelligence, and they start doing covert operations. And to give one key example, they get very involved in Angola. Why involved in Angola? Because Congress had passed the so-called Clark Amendment, I think in 1975, which prohibited the CIA from conducting any more operations in Angola. So they got around the problem by having other people do what the CIA had done, and they were in close contact.
I see.
This
yeah.
is where the deep state comes in. These were not formal connections between the CIA and the Safari Club. This was a network of old boys like Richard Helms. And, of course, George H.W. Bush, when he was head of CIA in 1976, was not a stranger to the agency, and he was not a stranger to the Middle East because he had run this offshore drilling company, Zapata Petroleum,
right.
which had contracts in the Persian Gulf with Kuwait. And so he was very much at home in that part of the world. And they just bypassed the regular bureaucracies.
Well, it sounds like the covert players formed their own kind of shadow CIA with their own rules. But do we know how the regular CIA leadership was viewing their activities?
Stansfield Turner was nominally the head of the CIA under Carter, but he didn't really know what was going on. He got rid of some people. Theodore Shackley being the most famous one. And those people, instead of just going home to write a book, they got involved with the Safari Club and advised them. So, and that's one of the two big things about 1976. But the other one, perhaps even more important, this prevented a restructure of the Cold War. The CIA had been advising for some time. This is the intelligence side of the CIA, as opposed to the covert operations side of the CIA, and there's always been tension between those two sides.
Yes.
They were saying that the Soviet Union is not the enemy that it once was. And this was anathema to the people who wanted to keep the Cold War going.
Sure.
This resulted in the head of the CIA at that time, Bush's predecessor.
Director Colby.
Yes, William Colby was fired because he was putting up these intelligence reports.
Right.
And George H.W. Bush, the father, was put in as head of CIA, and then he created something called Team B, which he brought in a bunch of these are the advanced neocons.
Yeah.
These are the predecessors of the people who created the project for the new American century in 2000, which really called for all the things that were implemented after 9/11. Back in 76, they said, no, the CIA's been wrong all along. The Soviet Union is a major threat, and they're spending a lot of money. In fact, they were spending a lot of money, but it was defensive. America had been spending so much against them.
Yes.
And, you know, when the missile crisis, it proved that America was on top. And
right.
The Soviets were trying to get parity, and I think the previous team had admitted that. But this got expanded into, no, the Soviet Union wants to take over the universe, certainly take over the globe. And we're still debating this a bit among the Soviet historians, but I think the consensus now is pretty much that the Team B assessment was wildly off base and that the original CIA assessment was closer. But the effects of this were huge because Carter had been elected on a promise to reduce the defense budget. That would have been, you know, returning to normalcy paths. And not only did he not reduce it, because of all these ominous threats from Team B, he expanded it. We talk about the Reagan increases in the defense budget. They became huge under Reagan, but they didn't begin under Reagan. They began under Carter. That, again, shows you how the president is not really the man who runs the country, and the processes that go on in the deep state, or in this case in the CIA, can determine his agenda in a way which he will not be happy with.
Yes.
It's another example where presidents don't set agendas, and I think that we've seen it with Obama recently.
Oh, yeah.
He made a Middle East speech back in 2009, which was very promising, but almost everything that's happened since then has worked against rather than in the spirit of his original speech.
So definitely.
That's when I say now the deep state is thoroughly ensconced in our government. And as I said, in American War Machine, there's a mindset in Washington, and the president doesn't choose the mindset. The mindset chooses the president. Regime we're in under now, I think.
Well, that really rings true when you look at the state of things now. A couple of things that you have in the book about how the deep state basically hijacked the COG planning and also FEMA, which is an agency that was originally set up to deal with natural disasters,
yes.
So like floods and earthquakes, for example. So essentially, the deep state figured out if we take over these two government functions, we can implement these authoritarian-style policies through them. Now, is that a fair statement?
My problem with what you just said, you're in the ballpark.
Okay, good.
My problem is I do not posit that there has been a secret conspiracy to take over the government.
All right.
I think there are processes always going on. I was 4 years in the Canadian government, and I spent 6 months in Washington in 1987 trying to help Senator Kerry investigate Contras and drug trafficking.
And that is a very good investigative report that Kerry put together.
Yes.
Going back to it now, it seems pretty advanced.
Kerry not in power was much better than Kerry in power, and that's unfortunately often the case with politicians.
Yes, well, it seems like all that he wants to do now is go in and attack Syria, basically.
Right. what goes on in government, particularly American government, which is so huge, nobody really controls it. I do think that people at certain moments made some key decisions. I think, I can't prove this, but I think there was a high-level decision that who made it, I don't know, but that Kennedy had to go.
And yeah.
I think it was a high-level decision that Nixon had to go. And it was a high-level decision that Carter had to go. But they were always ad hoc things, not like this is step one in establishing the deep state. It was just, no, the president has to go. But once these processes are in motion, then they acquire their own logic. For example, if the governing media of this country commit themselves to the position that the president was killed by a lone nut with no connections to anything, even though he had extensive CIA files and FBI files.
Oh, yeah.
Then they're committed to lying for eternity, really.
Yes.
You know, for them to tell the truth about the Kennedy assassination would mean to have to say we participated in a lie for the public good, but nonetheless a lie.
Uh-huh.
So that's just an example of what I mean about processes acquiring their own logic. And I think it's not been a single group. You know, when I talk about how the COG Doomsday Network has been involved, that's not always the same people. You get overlaps. There are overlaps between people in the Kennedy assassination and people in Watergate. In fact, I'd already written a manuscript about the Kennedy assassination before Watergate, and in it I had mentioned a man called Frank Fiorini, who under a different name turned up on the front page of the New York Times as one of the Watergate burglars.
Interesting. And this is Frank Sturgis.
Yes, Frank Sturgis was Frank Fiorini. And there are examples over and over and over, but there is, I think, no example of somebody involved both in the Kennedy assassination and also in 9/11. No, these are processes. The instruments are there, the machinery is there, the personnel keep changing. Cheney and Rumsfeld were definitely part of this transition in 1976 because it really happened when Donald Rumsfeld was chief of staff under Ford in the White House and Cheney was his number one assistant. So they've been around from 1976 right through the COG planning right down to the implementation on 9/11 and the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War.
So they're key players in this sense because they were in the Ford administration during that crucial transition.
Right.
Then they were key to setting up COG in and out of government.
Right.
And then Cheney shows up as defense secretary under Bush 1 versus Saddam in Desert Storm.
Right.
So we have all that. And then later they show up in the Project for a New American Century running ads that say, you know, we need a new catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor, to get people to support their vision of America.
Yes.
And America's role in the world.
Publicly for what they were planning privately.
Yes, exactly.
There is that link between PNAC and the COG planning. And there was a kind of plan brought up when Cheney was Secretary of Defense in 1992. And the deep state has many factions in it.
Okay.
Somebody thought this was too extreme and leaked it to the New York Times. And so it didn't happen in 1992. It had to wait until George W. Bush after 2001. There's one other thing about Cheney. Frequently, we have these deep events and then we get a commission or we get an investigation. In the case of Iran-Contra, there was a joint special committee of Congress that, quote, investigated, close quote, Iran-Contra. And it was, from my point of view, largely a whitewash.
Yes.
Because they didn't really get into the drug aspect of it, which was huge. And Cheney was the senior Republican congressman on the House side of that.
Uh-huh.
And he produced a minority report at the time, which essentially said Reagan was right to do all these things and not. All he violated were these post-Watergate reforms, which were terrible. We should never have had them. And that has always been, Cheney is the, of the two, Cheney was the intellectual, if you like, the theorist.
Okay.
And who frequently, again, he was on a plane with a bunch of journalists, and he took time out to say how wrong Congress had been to try and establish limits and congressional restraints on the CIA. So that, yes, he has been a theorist, but this is not all attributable to one man or two men or 10 men.
I see, yeah.
The process, the deep state interferes with the public state.
Well, it's very interesting that one of the key mechanisms that the deep state likes to use to intrude on the public state is CIA operations.
First of all, one thing we have to realize is that the CIA is connected in one direction with Congress and government, but it's connected in another direction with Wall Street and Big Oil and other major U.S. international corporations. And the history of the CIA really begins on Wall Street with Alan Dulles, when he is a lawyer, drawing up a kind of charter which then goes to Washington and becomes the National Security Act. So Truman originally did not want a CIA, and when Donovan had a plan to perpetuate the OSS that was the wartime predecessor of the CIA, Truman threw it out. And eventually he accepted a CIA, but he was very careful. CIA was full of Wall Street people at the vice director level, but the head of it, Truman, never chose someone from Wall Street. He always chose someone from mid-America in the western states where he himself was from. And then after Kennedy was assassinated, Truman made a very important intervention, which was immediately challenged in the media, but I think he spoke truth. He said, like 2 weeks after or so after the Kennedy assassination, said, when I set up the CIA, I never intended them to get into these covert operations.
Right.
I think history will bear him out on that.
Well, let's take a look now at how the CIA got into the business of covert operations. You know, we have the National Security Act that creates the CIA in 1947. So where's the first major covert action that sets the tone for all of these secret projects to come?
The very first covert operation was in 1948 when they put money into the Italian election to help defeat the Communist Party. Well, that was a Wall Street operation, which then the CIA took over at the insistence of Alan Dulles, who was still a lawyer on Wall Street.
Wow. So Dulles at the time didn't even have an official government position yet.
Right. And then they said, well, we're going to do this sort of thing. Well, we have to set up something. But they didn't set it up in the CIA. They set up something called the Office of Policy Coordination, which is, you know, meaningless words.
Yeah.
And that became it immediately had a much bigger budget than the CIA, and it did a lot of really dangerous things, some of which has still never really been properly recorded, like fighting a civil war in the Ukraine, which is coming back to haunt us now in 2015 because it's at the source of the tremendous hatreds inside the Ukraine today. And they got into tension with the CIA, and the result was they said, we have to get the OPC under control. So they merged it into the CIA. Huh. And the effect of that was that the it wasn't a case of the CIA taking over OPC. It was much more the opposite, that OPC came in underneath and then took over the CIA, and the CIA has been dominated by its operations officers ever since.
So could we say that the OPC was basically the covert arm of the CIA, and then at a certain point it gets the upper hand on the entire agency?
Yes, but the CIA had a hand in controlling the OPC at the beginning, but so did the Defense Department, so did the State Department.
I see. So the OPC were really on the loose, setting up their own actions, and the CIA basically tried to get a handle on them by merging them into the agency. But it sounds like it backfired in a sense.
The CIA did not control OPC in that era. And the same head of CIA, General Beadle Smith, was adamant in calling for getting the OPC under control. It came under control into the CIA just as Eisenhower was elected president, and that meant that Alan Dulles came in as the new head of the CIA and was immediately started planning major covert operations like the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran, which was a favor to the oil companies, and also the overthrow of Arbenz in Guatemala 1 year later in 54, which was a favor to United Fruit and International Railways and the Schroeder brothers. But Schroeder brothers were also the bankers for Anglo-Iranian oil, so you were benefiting the same people in the deep state. Alan Dulles was the beginning of the era of major covert operations. Truman was asked to authorize the overthrow of Mossadegh, and he refused. Instead, he sent Harriman to Tehran to work out a deal. And Harriman proposed what I think was the sensible deal, which was that Anglo-Iranian should split its profits with the Iranian government, and Mossadegh accepted, and Anglo-Iranian refused, because even though that's what was happening with in Saudi Arabia with Aramco and the Saudi government, the British were too stiff-necked. They didn't want to see, maybe too dependent, actually.
Right.
They were pretty poor at that time. Anyway, they didn't accept it. But the important thing is that Truman is right. He didn't authorize that kind of operation. He never did.
Interesting.
He had to wait until Dulles became the DCI for those things to be the trademark of CIA.
Well, when you think about Eisenhower, who worked with Dulles and the CIA in that period, with some major intel actions going on, like Guatemala and Iran, do you think he came to see the threat of all this covert activity? Because, of course, at the end of his term, he gave a public address on television with a farewell warning about the military-industrial complex. And if we go back and watch that, you can't really find another speech with a president warning about the military the way he did.
It's interesting the way he wrote it. He didn't use his regular speech writers. It was done, it was almost a plot against the deep state to get that speech into the record. Just as the same thing with President Kennedy, you know, he made the speech which may have led to his murder. In June of 63, the American University speech where he said, "We are all mortal,"
yes,
and really called for an end to the Cold War. And he, too, had to, in a very secret way, get that speech into the record. Eisenhower was leaving anyway, and Kennedy was, of course, killed 6 months, 5 months later. Eisenhower was, I think, never a hawk. I mean, these things happened under his presidency, but I think he delegated covert operations to his vice president, a young politician called Richard Nixon, and was not very interested in what happened. A couple of key decisions came up to him, and one was whether to back the French at Dien Bien Phu and use atomic weapons. And calls for this were coming from within his apparatus. And he was an experienced warrior, and he knew the horrors of war.
Right.
And his basic thrust was to keep big wars out of the picture. And the downside of that was he wasn't very interested in small-time covert operations, small from his point of view,
right,
overthrowing the prime minister, the elected prime minister of Iran, or the elected prime minister of Guatemala. That was just something he didn't get involved in. The key commitments that got us in